Next is Dennis Klass. He's from HVS Heartland Video Systems. He got his start in television in the Milwaukee market. He was a student at MATC and also student engineer at their two stations, and also worked at WTMJ before going on freelancing and starting to sell broadcast equipment. And he's going to talk about encoding features. You know, some of the new encoders are just fantastic, and he'll tell you more about it, but I just installed a new set, and you know, they eliminate a lot of equipment, so it's really cool. So Dennis, you're good to go.
All right, well, thanks for having me here today. Hopefully most of you know who I am. I've been around Wisconsin broadcasting for a long time. And we've been part of the clinic since it was over on the east side of Madison and a leaky roof and all of those things. So I really appreciate your support throughout the years. I think a great thing about broadcasting is it continues to change. You can be in this business for decades and the technology is different every year. It's not a static industry for sure. And we've worked with encoding for a long time. And I think just like our Green Bay Packers, we have to continue to adapt to new tools and new technologies that we have. So a few overviews that I wanted to go through here today. Some of the goals of where we started with ATSC1, I won't spend too much time in memory lane, but I think it's worthwhile to understand a bit of where we started and what got us here, and look at where we moved along the years. Our first encoders were encoders, and now our encoders are much more than just an encoder. Where virtualization has moved us, it's quite a change. Today, all of our encoders are virtualized. The days of the hardware encoder are pretty much gone. And there's a lot of new features and functions. You may have a new encoder that you're not aware of all of these things that it can do. So I wanted to kind of share some of those features and functions that we've seen. Talk about some common and different features in ATSC 1 and ATSC 3. Definitely it's a concern for everyone. What does the future look like if I'm ATSC 1 today and moving to ATSC 3 in the future? How do I prepare for that? System design changes is I think the phrase we often use is function collapse. We're looking at more and more outboard equipment being pulled into what we do inside of the encoding platform. And there's some benefits, but there's also some challenges. Now you have a lot of eggs in one basket. And if that platform fails you, then you have to really look at your redundancy and that sort of thing. Also wanted to touch a bit on cloud and on-premise considerations. We're starting to see a real merge between the two, and where things are located are not the same as you might be used to. So if we look back in the 1990s, when we started looking at compression, it was a big deal just to compress an HD video. I think the old analogy I always liked was, you know, if you take a Jenga wall of 1,500 bricks, 1.5 gigabits of video, or megabits, sorry, and remove all but 19 of those bricks, and your wall is still standing. That's pretty crazy, right? And that's what we do with technology. But you know, now we're removing all the bricks, but what, 7 or 8, and the wall is still standing. So it's pretty amazing when you step back and think about what we're able to do with compression. And I'll talk a little bit later about the number of services we're seeing on air. But you know, things like an HD and 6SD are on air in our state, right? Our technologies have really changed. And really, at first, it was MPEG-2 compression with just a basic tool set. And there's a lot of competition. There's always been multiple vendors in the space, and they keep leapfrogging each other. And I think it really benefits the broadcaster, because there's always new features coming. Prices are dropping. When you look at the pricing, originally, we were talking $100K for our first encoders we sold. You know, you look at what other things cost then compared to what they cost now, how many things drop in price by more than half and give you more features. It's just a crazy thing in the technology world. At that time, a single processor couldn't handle HD video. We had to use multiple chassis or multiple processors to make it happen. So, in just those two decades' time, so much has really changed technology-wise. This might be a little bit of an eye chart, but this is an example. Sorry, this is from a TV broadcaster that's no longer a TV broadcaster, so I left their name in it. But, you know, this goes to show in the 20 years ago, we were looking at so many individual components to put a system together. Each one of these had its own manual, had its own power supply, had its own learning curve of how to make it work. And we were mixing all sorts of signals, analog, digital audio, digital video, HD and SD, and upconverting, and we were learning new things like ASI and SMPTE 310, and this is so old it might still be called SSI here. So it was really a first generation thing, and I think as every technology works, we learned as we went along. These first systems got us on the air, generally doing one HD, maybe an HD and an SD, and we passed the network HD, and during the rest of the day we upconverted our SD. They were pretty simple systems, but they surely started us along down a road which has come a long ways. The next systems, as technology improved, they become really complex, right? This is a public broadcaster system from probably the late 2000s, where we had multiple HD and SD encoders with a distributed system. This was probably a good rack of equipment with redundant multiplexers, 1+1 HD and N+1 SD encoders, redundant Triveni. I'm sure Ralph was wishing we were doing this all the time, right? So these systems were pretty involved. They got us more services on the air, but they were complex. I mean, this was multiple days to set up. Just maintaining this beast was a job, right? There was a lot going on in these systems. At this point, we were hardware-based encoders and multiplexers with a PC-based PSIP guides and a system controller for our STATMUX controller. So it's a little bit of a marriage of hardware and software at that time. But it was sure a major undertaking to build these systems and to maintain these systems. And they certainly were power hungry, which is something new that we're starting to look at more and more, is your total cost of ownership of looking at your BTUs as well as just your power expenditures. So all of those things weren't real great back in these days. But we got the job done. Then we moved into the late 2000s, and the integrated hardware platforms became popular. I try to show different brands here. As a reseller and systems integrator, it's like our kids. We love them all, but there's been quite a few brands that come and go throughout the years. So I'm trying here to talk in general about most of the equipment out there. The integrated hardware platforms, we started to pull that distributed architecture into a box. Might be two rack units, might be one rack unit, might be capable of more or fewer channels. But we started taking our first steps into a combined system that did more things, generally with a web page interface. So we didn't have the separate control computer necessary. We didn't have all of those outboard pieces of equipment that we used to have. So the STATMUX controller, the multiplexing, the PSIP carousel, that was all built into the box, right? And then you controlled it with a web page. So these were kind of the good old days, right? The equipment was small. It was pretty easy to operate with a web page, but that was never going to last, right? So we had to make things more difficult and start a new series at some point. So the next series on from here was virtualization. And We really hit to a point where IT servers were powerful enough to handle video encoding. I think when we started back in the 90s, we were talking about hardware processor chips that couldn't handle an HD. Well, now we've come to a point where servers are able to handle our whole ATSC encoding needs in one server, as well as providing more of these functions I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. So the processing power just continues to multiply over time, and we take advantage of that with our encoders. So there's a few different motivations to virtualize. Hardware design is, of course, expensive and time-consuming. I think one of the best examples is 3D. When they're designing a processor chip, they have to look forward. So they take a piece of that chip and they design 3D into that chip. Well, we saw what happened with 3D in the marketplace. Didn't really go anywhere, but we still had a piece of our encoding set aside to do 3D processing we could never use to do other things. And it just that tremendous look ahead that's required for hardware makes it difficult for vendors to keep bringing out new product, lower prices, do all of those things the market wants to see. You take a new codec, you know, when MPEG-4 came out and HEVC came out, doing these things in hardware needs new chips. Well, that takes some time. And we started to look more and more as an industry of moving this over to software. Just as we saw the servers become faster, we're starting to see the channel loading increase, right? As I mentioned before, we're looking at HD and 6SDs and things like that. Some of those first hardware encoders were designed for 4 channels. That was about the limit of MPEG-2 at the time, so it made a lot of sense. Now we're looking at higher channel counts, so we're able to use these more powerful servers to do all sorts of things. Separate feeds for cable, or ATSC 1 and ATSC 3 in a single box. We have quite a few markets doing duopolies or triopolies in one encoding system now. So you look at the horsepower in these servers, it's really changed the game and what we're able to do. So we're really limited by the platform, right? Not fixed in hardware designs and in what we can do. I think if you look at the vendor side, they had people designing encoding for ATSC. They had other people doing web-based encoding. A video server is really an encoder with a hard drive, right? So they had an encoder team doing video servers. And you had all of these parallel teams. That's a lot of overhead. And as we start to move to the software module that we're looking at, we can combine those teams, which makes our vendors more efficient, cost-effective, bringing more to us as broadcasters as far as the price or the value of the equipment that we're getting. It also allows us to transcend hardware platforms. So in the past, we'd wait till the new hardware box came out, and then, oh, look at all these new features we get. Now it's really just a progression to the next server. In many cases, we have what we call mobility, where we can move our software from our old server to our new server. We don't need to buy the software all over again. This is a major change over our hardware life cycles. So there's a number of reasons to move to virtualization. It's sure fair to say that our first ventures into virtualization were a bit clunky, harder to operate than the hardware boxes that came from them. But such is progress, right? Our first ventures with virtualization really were using virtual machine software such as VMware. So what our vendors did at that point were to take a Windows generally or Linux-based system that was designed to operate on a whole machine. It wasn't made to work in an environment with other software. So the virtual machine software would compartmentalize that machine into multiple virtual machines. So we could have an encoder, we could have a MUX, we could have the control system, the StatMUX controller, sitting as 3 apps on a machine, all thinking they were on their own machine. That got us by for the first generation. It works. It does make a fair bit of overhead because now I have another layer of software taking resources on my machine. As we move into the more current versions of virtualization, we've moved into Docker or container-based applications. And with these applications, I lose that other operating system layer. So there's some advantages to that I'll talk about in the next slide. So for one, Docker is the general structure of a data center. So if you look at a vendor, just as I mentioned before, if we have to design encoding software for an encoder and then for a server, then for a web encoder, it's the same thing of designing software for a data center application, a very large customer, or an on-premise hardware-based system. Well, as we move towards a container-based software design, it's one piece of software. If you're in some big DirecTV center or if you're at a local TV station, it's not a different package of software anymore. So that really is some advantages on the vendor side of what they're required to have in-house, right? How many people does it take to make this happen? And along with that goes the customer support and the ongoing development work. It's all along one train now instead of multiple different simultaneous paths for the same sort of work. There's some security issues and there's operating system upgrades required. We're starting to lose as we get into the container-based world. So those are always an issue. We have an on-air system. The less we have to touch it, the better. So we're trying to have fewer levels of software that we need to maintain. And of course, that leaves us with more processing power to do the actual function of the machine. The more layers of software we have, it's just we're chewing away on all the software that to get to the actual application. So in general, this is saving us on our initial cost as well as our ongoing support. So if we look at a few just general features of virtualized encoding of where we are, and again, my all current vendors, I'm just kind of amalgamating things a little bit there of what we're doing with various encoder vendors. If I look at a few in the state, you know, WGBA, WTMJ, WBAY, and WFRV are all doing an HD and 6SD, if I'm correct. So. If we would have thought about this 10 years ago, no one would tell you can do it, right? And this has become pretty common. Obviously, as we work with ATSC 3 markets, the requirement of loading our StatMux becomes not really an option, right? We have to take all these sub-channels we're doing and make it work with one less transmitter in the market. So it's something we see around the country as we do lighthouses. These markets really become loaded, and we're not having tons of viewer complaints or issues as the quality of our encoding has become better and better, or the efficiency has become better. Generally, our new encoders are now single rack units. So we look at power consumption over that big distributed system I showed you before. That was a lot of power going through that system for the years of its life. We're now looking at a single rack unit. So as far as cost, power, size, it's much different. Now they are a little deeper. Your old 32-inch racks maybe aren't so friendly with these new servers, but those are all things we need to update, right? The RCA racks have to go at some time. So we're also doing some others. I just mentioned here 2HD, 5SD. WVTV, KSEE, they're in Fresno, and WXYZ in Detroit. So there's a lot of different combinations, and you know, your success may vary depending on the video content, what networks you're carrying, how you configure your StatMux. There's that old network contract, which is something we hate to bring up, but it's often there mandating our bit rates. So these are all things to think about, and surely talk to your general manager as they're working with corporate and negotiating network contracts to get rid of some of those old numbers that I've heard, you know, 15 megabits, you know, required. It's like we just don't have space for that anymore, so nor is it needed. So something new here are IP inputs and outputs. They've been available on encoders for a long time, but I'll show there's a new twist or two. We've added SRT as a standard feature or an optional feature in a number of encoders. So if we're moving content to and from a facility from elsewhere, we now have this IPIO available. Things like video up, down, and cross conversion. Many stations now are bringing in things like sub-channels as HD. They run it into the encoder as HD and let the encoder down-convert the signal. And we're finding better video quality that way than if we're doing the down-conversion upstream, like in something like a satellite receiver. Adaptive pre-processing. If you saw back in that other slide, back in the day, we used to have pre-processors that were we'd tweak to do noise reduction, edge filtering, all of these things to try to make our encoded video look better. Our encoders have some really high-end processing available. We used to have licenses that we had to sell, like auto concatenation, which is looking for MPEG artifacts in the input video, and iframe matching, things like this. They're just part of the encoder now, where they were really extra options we had to buy in the past, and it's pretty crazy, all of the features that are just standard in an encoder. The good news is the encoder vendors have made many of these features pretty much self-tuning. You know, in those early days of auto concatenation, the pages of menus or lines of code that you had to go through to make these things work were overwhelming. Now the encoder has a lot of intelligence to look at your input video and adjust its needs based on your content. Redundant systems now are generally completely isolated with an intelligent downstream switch. Those older systems often had a common system controller and common elements that made your redundant system maybe not fully redundant. With the way these server architectures work, we generally have a main and a backup system that don't talk to each other. They're wholly autonomous, and you have a smart switch selects the on-air version. It's really full 1+1 or hot standby, as we'd prefer. So this thought of function collapse, so what does this all mean? What sort of features have we added into the encoder? There's some we've been doing for some time. Some of these are newer. Audio leveling is one we've had for some time, where we can do standard audio leveling at a service level inside the encoder. I'll talk a little bit later about new features I see coming in audio. But audio leveling is one that is not a whole lot to show on a graph. It's what you would expect from column processing. Nielsen audio watermarking. You know, there's a number of ways to do this audio watermarking in your station. Generally, Nielsen might be done in a standalone card, the SDI IO. It can be done in an audio processor. But doing it in the encoder has some advantages, and it's generally much cheaper to do it in the encoder. There's sometimes a case to do it externally if you have a pickoff that's SDI for a satellite or a web provider. Some of them want an SDI signal. Then you may want to do it externally. But if that's not required, you could certainly do it inside the encoder. I do have a slide on satellite and off-air inputs. So these are new input modules on our encoders, and this opens up a new option of things that I maybe would buy externally in the past that are now included in our encoder. So we can actually take a L-band satellite input as an input to our ATSC encoder, insert EAS on it, which I'll talk about in a second, and it becomes part of our StatMux. Nothing more needed. That's pretty crazy, looking at all the items we used to have in an air chain. I talked earlier about SRT input and output. Our encoders are starting to do PSIP fetch. It works for some. There's some features it doesn't have, but that's something worth mentioning. EAS insertion, which is definitely something that's required on each service. So the fact that the encoder vendors have provided EAS insertion as a feature is a pretty cool thing for us. Mixed ATSC 1 and ATSC 3 operation. and PSIP edit features. So there's a lot going on there. So I have a few slides to talk about what some of these things mean. Satellite or RF input cards. So I didn't want too many slides. So it's safe to say most of our encoder vendors are using servers that say something like Dell or HP on them. So they're going to have a few option slots. One of the option slots is generally always an SDI card. Most of our vendors now have an SDI or ASI option. So that would take a slot. Normally there's about 8 inputs or out connectors on that card. One of the card slots could be an RF card. And the L-band card is different from the off-air card. But this opens a lot of options to you. So I mentioned before the one of bringing in something like a sub-channel over L-band. Instead of having an external satellite receiver, I can now bring that L-band signal right into my encoder. There's some DR capabilities there. You know, let's say I need to move my encoder to my transmitter site. How do I feed that? Could be off-air, could be satellite, but it's another option to bring content into my encoder and not need an external piece of equipment. There's some monitoring cases for RF input. The RF inputs can be ATSC1, ATSC3, where you could potentially pull in a monitoring feed and feed it back to some other location. Remember, I said the encoders have SRT out. So you could take your off-air feed, re-encapsulate it with SRT to feed it somewhere to monitor it. Another feature that would normally be done on an external device, we can now do inside the encoder. There's multiple channels of RF, be it satellite or off-air, HVSB or ATSC3. So it's not just a single input either. So there's a lot of different cases where this can be used, and this is fairly new. So you might have an encoder that's capable of this and didn't even realize that it was there. SRT inputs and outputs. Again, if you're not familiar with SRT, it is one of the first common standards. Haivision put out the standard and then made it kind of a public thing that's free for people to use. It's an ARQ-based standard that allows transmission over an IP network. Could be as unclean as the internet, right? So SRT inputs or outputs allow us to send compressed content to and from places. In the past, we'd often have an SRT or RIST is another technology that's a little newer that has some features people like, so I'd expect that we'd see SRT coming on most of our encoders as well. We can also get, I didn't show it in some of the redundancy schemes, but we can also use SRT or the L-band or the RF inputs as redundant inputs on encoder. So I can have a service set for maybe SRT as the main input with an off-air from another transmitter somewhere else or L-band as my backup input and let the encoder do the redundancy switching for me. I don't need all these upstream boxes to make that happen. So SRT-IO really makes for a lot of other possibilities without adding external equipment. PSIP fetch. Typically our PSIP comes from a guide service or if in a public station it normally comes from ProTrack. The encoders now have the ability to fetch PSIP from those sources and carousel it on our output. There are also some standalone devices. Many of you might be familiar with the old Nevion CP505. They're at their last production run and going end of support, and so looking at how to replace some of those is a question, right? So PSIP fetch is a new feature from a few vendors and allows you to take PSIP directly from the guide source and air it on your ATSC stream. There's a few things that you may want a PSIP system to do. It does not provide some of the other ability to utilize multiple sources of PSIP. When we start looking at channel shares, especially in a lighthouse market, sometimes your PSIP sources may vary depending on the services you're carrying. And in those cases, you might want something like a guide builder that's going to take in those multiple PSIP sources and handle them. There's also some day of air changes. Remember, this was a big thing some years ago, and then the FCC dropped it when the economy was bad, and they never brought it back. But those old day of air changes are something that these systems weren't really designed to do, right? That's something where you might want to use a PSIP system for those. EAS is a new one that I think we're going to see more traction, probably as a lot of old gear wears out. Most stations would have an EAS keyer for each service. And this works, right? We have an SDI input and output EAS keyer, and it has the complexity, though, of requiring GPI data and audio from our EAS system. So if I'm going to do seven services, typically my HD might be handled differently because I do something different for it. But all of those sub-channels or dot channels, I'm probably going to do something that looks a lot like this. So now I have to run contact closures, serial data out to a bunch of cards, and that's not really that fun, is it? So we looked at what's a better way to do this. What we've moved to is a single IP connection from a DASDEC into our ATSC encoder. And this will do the crawl and the audio duct just like we're used to doing per service. You do need the EAS net option from the DASDEC. And the audio comes through the EAS net as well as the data and the trigger. So it's for all your services. So one convenient little IP connection, I now can handle my EAS. It generally is DASDEC required, so if you're using a different brand of EAS system, that might be a problem. Pretty much the DASDEC is probably 85% of the market, so I think they're designing around that one because it's most common. PSIP edit and EAS at transmitter sites. This has been pretty popular for public broadcasters. We used to have multiple boxes that would go to a transmitter site to accomplish local EAS. You know, as a public broadcaster, you always had to make the choice, do I do statewide EAS and ask somebody in Waukesha to see the Barron County tornado alert, or do I do this locally? Doing it locally is a real nice service to the viewer that you're not bothered with statewide EAS, but it required a lot of equipment. Now we're able to do this EAS function and PSIP edit, so we're able to adjust the transport stream ID and the short channel name of the service right in the encoder. And along with this, this is using the full quality encoder, because when we insert EAS, it created some real STATMUX issues. A lot of our old EAS inserters that did this at the transmitter site converted our beautiful STATMUX into a fixed bit rate, and it didn't really help our quality. Now we're able to use the full quality of our ATSC encoder really at the transmitter site to do the EAS insertion and the PSIP edit. So maybe it's not for everybody, but it's pretty nice if it's something that you need. We look at combined ATSC-1 and ATSC-3 encoding. Another thing that really I think competition has created is a change in how encoders are licensed. Encoding is now licensed pretty much by all the vendors as a resolution, not by a codec. So back some years ago, you'd buy an MPEG-2 HD license. The new flavor, you now buy an HD license, and that can be HEVC, MPEG-2, or MPEG-4. So that's a pretty nice advantage. So as these servers have become as powerful as they are, we only sell one flavor for all of our vendors in that vendor's systems, and they're capable of ATSC-1 or ATSC-3, which is a pretty cool place to be in the technology curve. You would expect, well, I'm going to have to pay a fortune more to get an ATSC-3 capable encoder. And that's really not the case. Our ATSC-1 encoder is our ATSC-3 encoder. There are some additional licenses like HDR and things like that if you want to do them, but they're, the basic encoding is, it's there. So that's a real nice advantage. We also have the power with these servers to really do ATSC 3 and ATSC 1 in one server. So it's not like this thing is sweating doing its work for just one station. So it's a lot of capability, especially when we start looking at additional feeds. If you're a Lighthouse partner and you have to do an extra HD feed, we're doing that right on your ATSC encoder. We don't have to buy another encoder for that. And we continue. Each year these servers come out, they're more and more powerful. And we're seeing more features coming. So I think that's the good news as far as the technology here. It keeps getting better and better. We're seeing more stations do high bit rate feeds to cable because we can. Right? In the past, this was like, I can't double my encoder budget to do that. I think I skipped it in an earlier slide, but one of the other things we're seeing is the way we license encoders. We're now able to do a redundant pairing in which our encoder vendors allow us to fully license our main encoder, and you buy a backup chassis, and the licenses are installed in that backup chassis as a 1+1 redundant system. The thought being, you're only using one at a time, why pay for two sets of licenses? So I applaud our encoder vendors by listening to the market and reacting with that capability. It also means all these other functions I've talked about now become redundant. So your EAS, your PSIP insertion, your whatever those features you're using, you now have it 1+1. And you think of all the outboard equipment you would have to buy otherwise to do 1+1, that's a pretty big deal. So I could go on for hours, but that's what I put together. And coming from Wisconsin, I thought I'd give you a little bit of Wisconsin humor and ask if you have any questions. All good. Answered all your questions? Oh.
So I was thinking through all the different functions that we have generally in master control as you're listing more and more of them that are just being built into the encoder. You think it's likely we are going to see things like news tickers, time and temp bugs, stuff like that as features in these encoders in any time in the near future?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that graphics layers are actually already coming online on encoders. So we're going to see that. I think we're going to see program playout, which is also, you, if you've been around the show, you've seen that here, is program playout on the encoder as well. So the new features continue to come, yeah.
Another question, I guess. I'm not seeing any other hands come up. With stations that are doing, when you started talking about a station doing high bit rate feeds for cable providers, that piqued my interest because we, I'm sure a lot of stations are finding ourselves, as upper management finds out that we can put more channels on and they see opportunities to make money, we become more and more constrained for, if we're on ATSC 1 for 19 megabits, that gets more and more crowded. And so the thought of doing a higher bit rate of especially our main network feeds, that sounds pretty appealing. What sort of bit rates are you seeing stations feed? Are they sticking within the ATSC standard and giving them a roughly 19, or are they going above that?
Yeah, I think there's two sides to that. First of all, if you can get a direct connection to cable, it's a redundant system to your transmitter, so that's nice. Should you have a transmitter issue, that you're able to have that as a backup. Generally, for the cable feeds, we're often running MPEG-4 at a higher, at a, something like 10 megabits per video. You could certainly run MPEG-2. Usually that direct feed to cable bit rate's not much of a concern, from the cable company side, right? They provide a large IP pipe. You can use as much as you want, so within reason. So typically those are pretty high bit rate feeds.
MPEG 4, around 10-ish or so for an HD.
Yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes?
I got a question. One of your slides I took a picture of, it says mixed ATSC 1 and 3 operation. What do you mean by that? Can you actually, with one encoder, put out both at the same time or what?
Yes, you can. So, okay.
So
let's say you're in a market where you have a duopoly. So you own two transmitters, and one is ATSC 3 and the other is ATSC 1. We could do both of those feeds on one encoding platform. That's, I guess, what I was trying to say with that.
Okay, but if you have one transmitter, you can do ATSC 3, but we're doing one right now. Can you put out both on the same transmitter?
No, they're mutually exclusive. So if your transmitter is converted, if you flash cut to ATSC 3, it's all ATSC 3. What we do find, though, if you're a lighthouse and you're doing ATSC 3 for you and other stations in town, you also still need to encode your ATSC 1 signals to send over to your partners to carry them on their transmitters, and you often need to feed something to cable. So there's, even when you're ATSC 3, you have these other encoding needs that you have to cover.
Okay, yeah, I'm still trying to figure out how ATSC 3 is going to work in this area, because my transfer is like 35 miles outside of Milwaukee, and how that would work for the lighthouse and the reception and grade B. Doesn't get further south too much than Milwaukee, so, but a lot of questions yet.
Yeah, it's an interesting time right now with lighthouses and navigating DMAs, that's for sure.
Who's going to be the lighthouse? That's my question. And everybody has sold their, yeah, you know, their all their stream time, multiple streams. Who has space for this? I still question how that's all going to work. So,
I could say we've been involved in almost 60 lighthouses, and we, I've yet to see a subchannel turned off. They always find a way. You get some pretty busy multiplexes, but it seems to be working. Now, when you start to do looking at down the road, when do we do a second or a third lighthouse in a market or ATSC 3? It's not really a lighthouse anymore. That's a real question, right? Then we can't just make it happen anymore. We have to start dropping services or dropping resolution or something like that. But we're not there yet. So.
Okay, thanks, Dennis.
Sure. Okay, thank you.